So when you read through this passage here in Galatians, one of the things that that is worth noting here in this is Galatians 5, and particularly verses 19, 20, and 21, is there's a long list of don't do this stuff. And, you know, when you deal with young people and you say don't do this, you're focused either on the stuff that people are doing all around them that you are fearful that they're going to get sucked into, or the things that you think that they actually might do, because they're the sort of things that people get drawn into. So so when you look at this list is a thing. You know, Paul's writing the Galatians and saying, don't do this stuff. But he's doing so because somebody is doing all these things. There's no reason to prohibit something that nobody is doing or that no one is thought of doing, that no one appreciates, that no one thinks matters. And so this list of things, when you look here in Galatians 5, 19 through 21, this is a list of things that are going on in the culture. And so why are they going on in the culture? Well, all these things are related in some way to pagan practices and pagan worship from the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th centuries. So in the Roman era in the West, these are the sorts of things that are involved in some of the pagan worship and the things that pagans do. So one of the great mysteries that we deal with in the patristic era as we think about the church in the West is this issue of, next slide, how is it that paganism, which is so dominant at the beginning of the first century and so imbued into the culture such that everyone's doing it, there are temples, multiple pagan temples in every city across the Roman Empire. Pagan practices are imbued into so much of what people do and how they do it and how they think about it. How is it that paganism basically goes away? Because pagan practices are everywhere here. So this is from the 19th century. This is a 19th century print, but it's a couple of young women who are engaged in the worship, preparing for at least the worship, stringing garlands here on the idol that they're worshiping. So this is a 19th century picture by an artist. And one of the things that's really interesting when you look at art that goes back is art that's made between about AD 500, functionally kind of the end of the real Roman period in the West, and about 1500, you know, kind of the height of the Renaissance, when people started to become really aware of other cultures outside of Europe. The art that goes in that 500 to 1500 millennium in the West, artists, when they're depicting biblical or ancient scenes, almost always make those people look like they're the people down the street. You know, Dutch art that comes in that period makes all the people in the Bible stories look like Dutchmen, wearing Dutch clothes, walking on the streets of Dutch cities. The Italian art that comes through that time makes people look like they're Italians and they're wearing Italian clothes and walk, you know, and so you've got this millennium where there's all this art, and you know, Joseph and Mary are going to Bethlehem, and Bethlehem looks like the town that's down the road from wherever the artist was living at the time, not like Bethlehem actually looked like, because the artist didn't know anything about that. So you get to the 19th century, and you get somebody who has a real sense of what Roman architecture looks like, what the idol might have looked like, how people actually dressed. And so, you know, this is an idealization by somebody, but at the same time, it's got some really accurate elements to it in terms of the kind of general look. These other two images are things that actually come from the ancient era. Marcus Aurelius engaged in making a sacrifice, and a sacrifice to the god Apollo going on here. But both of these are things that were, you know, carved works from that era. You know, so these are things that were made by people that were engaged in pagan worship, in which have lasted down through the ages. And paganism, a lot of strange to that. And the things that people talk about paganism today are not the things that we're talking about when we talk about paganism in the patristic era, in the Roman era. You know, when people talk about pagans today, they're mostly talking about, the guys that build the circles of rocks, the druids. They're talking about Wicca, nature worship. People who say non-ironically that they are pagans today are people that are kind of nature worshipers. There's not a lot of connection between that and the paganism of the New Testament era and the early church era. The paganism of the early church era has a lot of variety, a lot of different strains, gods, temples. It is a system with multiple gods where the gods are in kind of a loose hierarchy, very polytheistic. And so, but there's a Greek pantheon with Zeus at the top and a Roman pantheon with Jupiter at the top and an Egyptian pantheon with Isis at the top. And for the most part in this era, these are kind of jumbled together. And there are Roman people that would say, oh, well, Zeus is just a different name for Jupiter. It's the same. And other people who would think, well, you know, maybe it's different and maybe I'll do both. But in pagan worship, people kind of picked the gods or goddesses that they liked and patronized the temples that they thought were most interesting or that did the stuff that was most popular or engaging at that point. A lot of mixtures here. Many of the temples actually hosted worship for more than one god. And different parts of paganism, different pagan practices, some of them became more popular and some of them less over time. And the Roman government was fairly successful in integrating the Roman imperial cult, the worship of emperors, particularly in the second century, is part of this. But from Julius Caesar in the first century BC up through close to the time of Constantine, the Roman imperial cult is integrated in this as well. And the most successful slices of paganism were what were called the mystery cults. The mystery cults were really like cults today, cult groups today, in the sense that the mystery cults, there were things that were known only to their members. You had to join to get in on the secrets. And then you had to make a higher level of commitment to get into the next level of secrets. And, you know, that ought to sound like something like Scientology or even, you know, Mormonism, really, has things. There are things that are protected things that you tell to only members, and there are things that people have to become very senior members before they're allowed to know. In Mormon worship today, you know, the Mormon temple is not for non-Mormons to go to, and large parts of the temple are not for most regular Mormons to be in or to be part of the things that go on there. There's a hierarchy of membership. There are shared secrets that are only given to certain people. And so the mystery cults of paganism had expensive or lengthy initiation processes. They were really clubs that had exclusive membership, and people wanted to be able to say, well, I'm in that club. And so there was a desirable thing. And this influenced the church to some extent, because people that came out of paganism and came into the church wanted to get that some of that feeling that this is an exclusive thing. We know something that nobody else knows. We have this thing. I'm part of this particular club. And this is a thing that, that in the church we have struggled with to some down through the ages and even today. because our worship is public. Our message is public. You know, you can read our book, the whole thing. We don't have a secret thing. You know, if you join the church, we don't actually tell you secrets. We all the stuff that you need to read and go through for church membership, we put on our website. You know, we don't actually have a secret handshake or anything, to the disappointment of some, right? But we don't do that. As Christians, our doors are open. So, but the most successful elements of paganism didn't really operate that way. There were secrets, and there were hurdles that people had to get over, and they had to be initiated. They had to be invited, those kinds of things. And, you know, fraternal organizations have long, in more recent years, have long worked in these same kinds of ways. Over the last few weeks, I've made a bunch of trips back and forth between here and Providence, and there's a billboard up for the Masons up there along Interstate 95. And, you know, there's secrets there. You know, if you become a member, you get in on some of the secrets. And as you go higher, you get more of the secrets. So some of these things really do come from ancient paganism. They're at least inspired by ancient pagan practices. They're aligned with that. So when you think about pagan worship was a major part of the life in Roman cities. When you read 1st and 2nd Corinthians and you're thinking about the church in Corinth, you got to keep in mind that the Aqua Corinth, the big high rocky hill there that overlooks the ancient city, had a road that wound up to the top, and at every flat spot along the way there was a pagan temple. And each of the pagan temples burned incense and had music and did other things to attract attention. And so when you were down in the marketplace at the base of the Aqua Corinth, you could hear the music coming from the temples up on the hill. You could smell the incense. They were constantly doing stuff to attract attention. And this is part of the thing about pagan worship, is because pagan temples, the image of the god was inside, but the people were outside. The people were in the plaza or out on the steps in the front, as we talked about when we talked about architecture. So pagan worship was relatively passive in the sense that you came to see the show in many cases, which is why there was so much emphasis on music and incense and sacrifices and feasting and pretty girls and those kinds of things, because they wanted to attract attention and give you a reason to come and then a reason to come back later on. And so pagan temples tended to be competing for your attention in very public ways. As you went past the temple, they were trying to do something dramatic to draw you in. There was some street theater kinds of elements to what pagan priests did and what pagan temples did. So a lot of focus on feast days and connections to the seasons and harvests. And paganism emphasized oaths and vows. And there was a sense in pagan worship that you had to make the correct prayer in the correct way, and that if you did it wrong, you would not get the favor of the god. And that this was such a big deal that in many cases you were wiser to pay somebody who was a professional prayer to pray the prayer for you so that they would get it exactly right, and you would have a chance to get the favor of the god, which you otherwise might miss because you hadn't done it right. But people that, you know, are in crisis and people that have difficulty and people that can't seem to conceive a child or, you know, whatever the difficulty is, often turn to pagan temples. And victorious Roman emperors down through the whole history of Rome tended to build, up until the time of Constantine, tended to build pagan temples in honor of various military victories and other things like that. And since paganism in the Roman Empire was state-supported, the government gave money, being a priest at a pagan temple was actually a pretty good gig. It was a defined income that came from the state. It was a public position that got you some respect, and it gave you control over what kind of music that you wanted the temple to have and what kind of incense you wanted it to burn and what kind of food you wanted to serve and stuff like that. And it's important to keep in mind that in this era, most people, when you went into their home, even if their home was only a couple of rooms, that over in the corner there was a little idol that they worshipped at least some of the time as a family. And so that this is built into the fabric of society and very dominant in Roman and Greek culture. That said, paganism is not one thing. It's a whole bunch of things going together. G.K. Chesterton said about paganism, "The pagan set out with admirable sense to enjoy himself. But by the end of his civilization, he had discovered that a man cannot enjoy himself and continue to enjoy anything else." So the pursuit of pleasure, which was core to paganism, led to the absence of almost anything else, in the absence of any other value in life. And so a lot of people think that paganism went away after the advent of Christianity in the West because Christians persecuted paganism. And there's some of that. Christians viewed pagan temples and pagan practices in their areas, in their neighborhoods, and to some extent in their cities as offensive, and often came out publicly against that. In some cases, there was violence there. And the Roman government eventually stopped supporting pagan temples, which was a gigantic financial blow to pagan practices. The government funding stream had been critical to the support of pagan temples and pagan worship. When that went away, a lot of pagan temples ended up closed because pagan temples did not have regular congregations. They got attention, people came, people enjoyed the thing, they maybe made contributions, and then they went away, and then they went to some other pagan temple's thing next week. And so, since there were relatively few people that were actually directly committed, there was almost no regular giving stream that would really support the pagan temple. And rich people tended to give to pagan temples only because it was socially valuable and socially acceptable. When that became less the case after the time of Constantine, a lot of that dried up as well. So Christianity did destroy paganism, but this is because there are some things about Christianity that are fundamentally superior. And so that's important to keep in mind. And it's important to keep this in mind just from the way that paganism works. The ancient paganism, pagan worship, was passive. It was observational. It was mostly you go to see the show. And Christian worship was mostly participative. It was engaged. You participated. You did something. You were part of it. This is a challenge that we have in the church today, right? Churches that come and put on a great show, and people sit in the pew and enjoy the show and go out afterwards and talk about, you know, the music and the smoke machine and the effects and, you know, all that sort of stuff. Those people, for the most part, are not high commitment, right? Those people are pretty low commitment, and when hard times come, they tend to fall away. And so this is one of the reasons why you can have a really big church that there's not a lot of substance there, because if the people are mostly there because the show is great, they're likely to be less commitment. And so, so strong churches today are better at getting people committed, getting people involved, and making people feel like they are part of what's going on. Pagan worship was really based on activity. Come to this feast, come to this sacrifice, do this prayer in this way. These elements are the boxes that you check. Christian worship and particularly early on, was very about relationship, our relationship with Jesus Christ, our relationship with one another. And that's much more powerful as a way of connecting people together, is building relational ties. People came to Christ. People came to the gospel in the early eras because they knew people who turned out to be Christians. And their web of relationship brought them into contact with those kinds of people. The pagan gods, none of the pagan gods, none of the stories about any of the pagan gods, whether you're thinking about the Greek system, the Roman system, the Egyptian system, or otherwise, none of the pagan gods really cared about people at all. All the pagan gods are basically, all the stories that are told, even by pagans, the pagan gods are very self-serving. They're in it for themselves. They're in it for the entertainment. They do stuff because, well, I can do it, you know, whatever. None of the pagan gods cares enough to exert themselves to help you in any way, really. Which is why you got to do things to get their attention. You got to have better music. You got to have better stuff. And it's why you got to do the prayers exactly. Why you've got to do the correct sacrifices, because you're hoping to get the attention of the god and hoping that the god will deign to take a moment to give you their favor and help you out with this thing, which the god may decide, no, I don't like you, and I'm going to spurn you anyway. And so pagans found that they went to worship and hoped that the god would give them some favor. Christians came and said, there is a God who loves you and who wants to give you grace. So the pagan gods despised mercy as weakness almost in every case. They thought being merciful, whether the God themselves being merciful or whether people being merciful, was basically weakness. It was wrong. Christians worship a God, the God of love, who created every individual and is merciful toward those who seek Him. So, pagan worship said, your engagement here is purely self-interested. You are here to get something from the God. You are hoping the God will do something for you. And the God is basically self-interested as well. The God is unlikely to do something for you unless there's something in it for the God. But Christianity brought a perspective that's driven by grace. So pagan worship, pagan practice said self-interest should drive the moral order, and self-interest should drive what you are doing. And you shouldn't help the poor unless there's something in it for you. Christianity came with a moral order that was based on mutual obligation, on sacrifice for the good of others, on mercy and grace. And in difficult times, that touched people's lives and touched people's hearts. So pagans didn't do social work. They didn't try to invent the hospital. They didn't take care of those in need when great plagues swept across the Roman Empire. Pagans didn't do that. Government didn't do that. Christians did that. Because Christians thought, it is worthy for me to risk myself, to exert myself, to do something that puts myself on the hook for the sake of others. And that was revolutionary. So pagans visited various temples, worshipped a variety of gods, seldom remained loyal to one over a long period of time. Christians worship the one God. Paganism mostly objectified women. You know, if you were young and pretty, you could serve at the temple and ignored women. There's very little value for women in any of ancient paganism. Women are valued to some extent basically for fertility, but very little otherwise. But early Christianity really valued and honored women, and the early church was heavily female. These things are related together, okay? Women who were in paganism became very aware that the pagan gods didn't care about them, that paganism didn't really create a place for them other than, you know, their ability to bear children, which was not valued in the society for the most part. And so, so the early church is heavily female. It was Christianity that pioneered the idea that marriage is a symmetrical commitment, that marriage is about two people who are bound together, and they are together. They are not one over the other. Paganism basically argued that when a man marries, he is acquiring a wife and taking possession of her for as long as he desires to have her. Christianity said, no, this is a partnership for the sake of the gospel. And so very different in that sense. Christians had children, valued children, strongly opposed abortion and infanticide, which were widely practiced in pagan culture, which did not value children. As a result, Christians had a lot more children than pagans. In over three or four or six generations, that matters a lot. The people that have children own the future. That is just true, down through the ages. Christianity had a mission that was to every tongue and tribe and nation across ethnic and cultural lines. It's an integrated community that includes Jews and Greeks and slaves and free, men and women and anybody else, people from faraway places and people from near at hand. Pagans generally worshipped with people that were like them and generally believed that their gods were basically ethnocentric and cared only about people like them and not about people who were far away and were therefore of no value. Particularly until the time of Constantine, Christianity was very high commitment and paganism was low commitment. Christianity was high commitment because you could get thrown in jail or you might get killed. Paganism was low commitment because everybody was doing it. It was supported by the government and you showed up if you wanted to. Paganism never created much community. It was a highly individualized thing. Christianity really fostered intense community. So paganism collapses. Particularly between the 4th and 6th century, paganism in the West mostly goes away. The temples, without state support, have few regular donors or patrons and don't get many big gifts, and a lot of them end up without adequate income to operate. Emperors mostly identified as Christians. It became socially important to do that. Many temples got demolished to make space for other things or were converted to other kinds of new uses. And paganism basically goes away. And it goes away not really because of persecution, but because it doesn't serve the needs of people. It's not what people need to navigate this life in a way that Christianity is. But that's one of the big underlying social things that is happening in this era and that is part of what is going on in the life of the church. It is the collapse of this gigantic pagan worship, pagan lifestyle, pagan culture that so infuses the entire New Testament era, that is a background. And yet, 5 centuries on, it has basically vanished, with the exception of some temples that are left over and standing empty. So, next slide. Another thing that happens here as we think about beginning in the 2nd century, but up through the 4th, 5th, and into the 6th century, is Manichaeanism. And we think when you hear that term today, when people start talking about Manichaean, they mean a binary where there is good and there is evil. And there's no gray, there is no nuance, there is no maybe, there is good and there is evil. And in this country, President George W. Bush was often accused of being a Manichaean in our public life. This was much in the press. during his term of office, because he uses, you know, the axis of evil. You know, you're with us or you're against us kinds of things. You know, there is good and there is bad kind of stuff. And there's a strain of that in American foreign policy going back, you know, two centuries. There are the good guys and there are the bad guys. And Manichaeanism is the place where these ideas really come from in the ancient world. Mani was a Parthian prophet in what was then Sassanid Persia. We say Sassanid Persia because the Persian Empire that you read about in the Old Testament is the empire, the Darius the Mede, remember that? Okay. That empire was destroyed by Alexander the Great. The empire that the Greeks fought against, Alexander the Great conquers the East, and when he dies, he sets up successor kingdoms. Sassanid Persia is the Persia that eventually rose after the Greek kingdom that Alexander the Great had imposed on that whole Central Asian area, had fallen corruption and eventually fallen apart. So the Sassanids are kind of the new Persian Empire, the later Persian Empire. In the 3rd century, a guy named Mani shows up there and proclaims himself a prophet. And he tries to take ideas that are borrowed from Christianity and Buddhism and Zoroastrianism and a little bit from Judaism and make a syncretistic thing out of that, with proclaiming himself as the new apostle. And that he, as the new apostle, is a successor to Zoroaster, who founded Zoroastrianism, Buddha, and Jesus. That Mani is the successor to all three of them. And then all three of them are the guys who came to tell us that Mani was going to come and that he was going to be the real true apostle. So there's some there's a Gnostic element to this, you know, a great dualistic cosmology, a good spiritual world of light and an evil material world of darkness. And some revering of Zoroaster and Buddha and Jesus is the forerunners of Mani. But the concept here is that the world is in a constant pitched battle between the forces of God and the forces of the devil. And God and the devil are kind of on the same level. That creation is the outgrowth of the interaction, the fight between God and the devil. That they both have their fingerprints on creation. That the world is marked by both good and evil. And that the good stuff comes from God and the evil stuff comes from the devil. And they're locked in this fight. And we're stuck in the middle. And we need to make choices based on that so that we will be aligned with the good and not with the evil. And so Manichaeanism created for a while, for a couple of centuries, as it spread from Persia both west all the way to what is now Britain and east into China, where it was very significantly successful. But Mani built an organization that had a single leader who was Mani and then his various successors. And then a hierarchy of apostles, bishops, and presbyters. Now, where did he get that? These ideas are mostly borrowed, huh? And this spread very quickly in the Aramaic and Syriac-speaking regions of the East. But Manichaeanism was a major religion of the 4th through the 7th century. And in the 5th and 6th century, it was the principal rival of Christianity. So the Roman Empire eventually began persecuting it before Constantine, and it faded out there. Persia later persecuted it. Manichaeanism actually survived in China into the 14th century. But basically all the early writings of Manichaeanism are lost. So why do I care about Manichaeanism? Well, there was a guy who spent a decade in Manichaeanism. He was the most significant figure in the church between Paul and the Reformation. And a guy who was a Manichaean for 10 years and then rejected it for Christianity was named Augustine. But he spent 10 years trying to track this down. And when he finally met the great Manichaean prophet of the West, who was going around explaining Manichaeanism after 10 years of pursuing this, Augustine thought, this guy's an idiot, and he doesn't know anything. And I've wasted a decade of my life pursuing something that just ain't so.